Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Hello, this is William Fink, and this is the 29th installment of Christogenos on August 7th, 2009. I don't believe I've done 28 of these already, but we have. This is the 26th Two Seed Line installment. And I'm fairly certain that we've already demonstrated that two seed line is a doctrine that permeates the entire Bible. If you doubt two seed line, I can't see how you could be a Christian. It's just incredible to me that people don't believe the Bible on its face and would rather just twist the words and evade things and spiritualize things and make up, invent false doctrines and pervert verses just to avoid the basic fact that there's an enemy of God that has children in the world that are persistently, from generation to generation, adversarial to the children of God in the world. It's very clear in the Bible, and it's perfectly clear in history. We're going to proceed with two seed line in the New Testament. Last week, Eli and I discussed the week before last. I'm just lost on time. We discussed the parable of the wheat and the tares in Matthew chapter 13. So I'm going to pick it up with Matthew chapter 14. And right now I'm going to read from 14:1 to 14 from the Christogenean New Testament. At that time, Herodias the Tetrarch had heard the report of Yahshua. And he said to his servants, "This is Johannes the Baptist. He is risen from the dead, and for this reason works of power operate in him. For Herodias, having seized Johannes, had bound him and put him away in prison on account of Herodias, the wife of Philippus, his brother. For Johannes had said to him, 'It is not lawful for you to have her.' And desiring to kill him, he had feared because of the crowd, because they esteemed him as a prophet. But with the birthday feast of Herodias coming to pass, the daughter of Herodias danced in the midst and pleased Herodias, from which he promised with an oath to give to her whatever she may ask. And being induced by her mother, 'Give to me,' she says, 'here upon a plate, the head of Johannes the Baptist.' And the king, grieving because of the oaths and those who were reclining together with him, commanded it to be provided. And sending, he beheaded Johannes the Baptist in prison, and his head was brought upon a plate and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother." Now, what makes a girl so bloodthirsty? That's incredible. According to Josephus, in his Antiquities, Book 18, Chapter 5, Herodias, this particular Herodias, was a daughter of Aristobulus, who was a son of the first Herod, the Herod that the Jews like to call Herod the Great. Actually, he was Herod the Great Edomite infiltrator. This girl was born by Berenice, who was the daughter of Salome, who was also a descendant of the first Herod. So both of her parents were descendants of the first Herod. So Herodias was also an Edomite Jew. Her mother was an Edomite Jew. And the whole family of Herod, if you peruse Josephus's Antiquities, they had intermarried together to a great degree. And the family history is actually pretty difficult to follow. You need a spreadsheet just to figure it out because they all have very similar names. The same names are repeated often from generation to generation. And it gets quite confusing because first cousins and uncle nieces and that there were all kinds of marriages that we just wouldn't perform today. And that's, well, they're Edomite Jews. They like to keep their bloodthirstiness and their murderous ways in the family, I gather. I wish they were still like that now. Anyway, Herodias was an Edomite. Just like her father was an Edomite, just like her mother was an Edomite, and that's why she had thirsted for the head of John the Baptist. She's the mother of a million Rosa Luxemburgs now, and they all thirst for Aryan heads all the time. So the two seed line story permeates the entire Bible. I want to talk about Matthew chapter 15, verse 1. Then the Pharisees and scribes came forth to Jerusalem to Yahshua, saying, "For what reason do your students transgress the traditions of the elders? For they do not wash their hands when they eat bread." And replying, he said to them, "For what reason do you transgress the commandment of Yahweh by your tradition? For Yahweh said, 'Honor your father and your mother.' And he speaking evil of his father or mother must die by the sentence of death." They're Old Testament laws. "But you say, whoever should say to father or mother, 'Whatever you may benefit from me as a gift,' shall by no means honor his father. And you have made void the word of Yahweh by your tradition." And basically what Yahshua is telling the Pharisees and the scribes is that through their legalism, they have forsaken, and the Edomites have no choice but to do so, the love for kindred that one should have naturally, and they've replaced that with a picayune, trivial, burdensome form of legalism that we have again today, because we've gone from a basic constitution in the English Book of Common Law that we had 200 years ago, and after the Jews became prevalent in our own legal system in the late 18 and early 1900s, well, today we have an IRS code that's like 80,000 pages, not to mention all of the other burdensome laws and regulations that we have from every agency in the country and every state in the union. So we have this same legalism again. And the love of community is again forgotten. A lot of people, I want to talk real quick where Yahshua talks about food. He talks about the things that are eaten. The Pharisees, they wash the outside. They pay more attention to the manner in which the implements and vessels are washed than they pay attention to the manner by which they filled the implements and the vessels. And Yahshua gives a discourse. And in Matthew, he basically says that everything that's eaten is cast down into the latrine, and that they can't harm the body. And some people use this as an excuse to eat unclean foods or even to eat poisons. And they actually challenge their faith in that manner. And that's not what he's saying here in Matthew, because if you look at the corresponding verses in Mark from verse 7:18 to 7:23, you'll see that the word food appears. And he's talking about food, and pork is not food. And that's a little aside, but it's not, you can't take one Bible verse out of context. You have to go look at everywhere that story, especially in the Gospels, everywhere it appears, because not all Gospel writers recorded everything the same, but they all recorded it accurately. And if Matthew left the word food out, we can surely fill that in from Mark. Matthew 15:21. And having departed from there, Joshua withdrew into the regions of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, the Canaanite woman from those borders, having come out, cried out, saying, "Pity me, master, son of David. My sick daughter is possessed by a demon." I'm sorry. But he did not respond to her a word. And coming forth, his students begged him, saying, "Dismiss her, for she cries out from behind us." So we see the apostles just wanted to get rid of her. Then replying, he said, "I have not been sent except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." But she coming makes obeisance to him, saying, "Master, help me." But he responding said, "It is not good to take the bread of the children and cast it to the dogs." Then she said, "Yes, master. Yet the little dogs eat from the crumbs falling from the table of their masters." Then replying, Joshua said to her, "O woman, great is your belief. It must be for you as you desire." And her daughter had been healed from that moment. There's a lot of contention, even in Israel identity, over this section. The first law of animal economics is that dogs don't get crumbs on purpose. A lot of people try to use this as an excuse to make the other races Christians, to say that somehow they could be saved, and that's just not possible because they don't have the spirit that Yahweh gave to Adam in the first place. So they have nothing to be saved from. They didn't participate in Adam's fall, so they sure as hell can't participate in Adam's restoration. It's just not possible. We don't throw crumbs to dogs on purpose. We spill crumbs by accident, and the dog might get lucky and get some. The woman stated a blatant truth, and for that unusual honesty, she got a crumb. Her daughter was healed. That doesn't turn either of them from a dog into a sheep. Neither does it save either of them. Yahweh set a mark upon Cain, the murderer Cain, the son of the devil. And Yahweh set a mark upon him so that no one would kill him. The tares have to be preserved along with the wheat, and that's the word of God, until the time designated by Yahweh. Now, there are a lot of things that are revealing in this parable, and I think that the entire episode actually happened for a greater reason, and it really doesn't matter if this girl was healed or not. Actually, she may have become the grandmother to some of our Edomite popes, but that's besides the point. I wrote a paper. It's on Christogenia. It's called "Don't Be Confused About the Canaanite Woman," and it basically explains that Matthew knows exactly what he's talking about when he calls this woman a Canaanite. That's what she is. Mark calls her a Syrophoenician. Mark is not wrong in his gospel in chapter 7. Mark is writing from a Greek perspective. They called that land and the people in it Syrophoenicians because that was the ancient land of Phoenicia. And after the Israelites were deported from it in 745 to 676 BC, the Greeks just continued to call whoever inhabited the land Phoenicians because they called the land Phoenicia. 200 years ago, you didn't have any Puerto Rican New Yorkers, and now Puerto Ricans are called New Yorkers all the time because they infested the city. They're still called New Yorkers. That's the way it is. The children of Israel were taken away. The Canaanites remained in the land. And the Greeks continued to call them Phoenicians. So Mark calls this woman a name by a Greek perspective, and Matthew calls her by her tribal name because he has a Hebrew perspective. There was a custom in the ancient world, and Livy writes about it, and Caesar writes about it, and Procopius and many other historians mention it, Polybius. And when a conquering general or when a dignitary of another state or a dignitary of the government, somebody of great stature, came through a city, and especially conquering generals, but it happened quite often elsewhere in other contexts. The poor people of the city, and not all of them, but occasionally a poor person of the city who had suffered some injustice or wanted mercy for some reason, they would throw themselves at the feet of the dignitary and beg for mercy or beg for some favor or beg that some injustice be righted. And this was actually, it's hard to quantify because it happens very often, but it's not anything that you'll find in the indexes of books, and it's nothing I bothered to record with all the classics that I've read. But anybody that's read the classics should recognize the story because it's happened over and over again. That a dignitary would visit a city or a conquering general would be in a city and people would throw themselves at his feet, usually clasp their garments, and not let go until they were given a direct answer. It was a very gracious act by a conquering general to grant such mercy, or by a conquering dignitary, a visiting dignitary, to make sure that some injustice was righted. And that was a common thing in the ancient world. And I believe that that is the same tradition that this woman followed here, and that Yahshua Christ, existing in a Greco-Roman society and living under a Greco-Roman custom, when this woman admitted she was a dog, he had no choice but to grant her favor. That's just the way it was. And he did it. But the more important thing is that the apostles, not being as gracious, they tried to run this woman off. That's hardly anything you would do for a prospective Christian. And it proves that the Canaanite woman is not a prospective Christian. And the apostles knew it. They wanted to run her off because she did not belong in the flock. And they were never admonished for that, which shows that their behavior was not unjust or improper. Now, there's a psalm, and Clifton Emmaheiser wrote about it in a pamphlet called The Power of the Dog, Psalm 22:20. And Psalm 22:20 makes it rather clear that the crucifixion would happen at the hands of the power of the dog. I'm going to read from Clifton's pamphlet, excerpts from Psalm 22. Clifton says this is from verses 7, 13, 16, and 20. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head. They gape upon me with their mouths as a ravening and roaring lion. Now I'm going to stop for a second and just note that Peter says in his epistles that the adversary walks around as a roaring lion waiting to devour whom he can. Verse 13, they gaped upon me with their mouths as a ravening and roaring lion. For dogs have compassed me. The assembly of the wicked have enclosed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. Deliver my soul from the sword. My darling, from the power of the dog. That's clearly a reference by David to the crucifixion. And it shows that it was the power of the dog by which Yahshua was crucified. The Canaanite woman is called the dog because it was the Canaanite Jews that killed Yahshua Christ. And that's the more important facet of this parable. there are sheep, and there are dogs. If sheep are people, then so are the dogs. And the wolves and the swine. And let's move on to Matthew chapter 16. 16:1. And coming forth, the Pharisees and Sadducees, trying, or tempting, had asked him to show them a sign from out of heaven. And replying to them, he said, a wicked and adulterous race seeks a sign, and the sign shall not be given to it except the sign of Jonah. And leaving them, he departed. Here he calls the Pharisees and the Sadducees a wicked and adulterous race. That's about all I have to say there. This goes hand in hand with the parable of the rich man and Lazarus, which is only found in Luke chapter 16. The morale of that parable is that even if one were to return from the dead, the Jews would still not believe him. If Yahshua himself could not convert the Jews, how blasphemous is it of the evangelical Christian Zionists to believe that they can do so? 16:5. And the students, having come to the other side, forgot to take bread. Then Yahshua said to them, watch and be on guard because of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. 16:12. Then they understood that he did not say to be on guard because of the leaven of the wheat loaves, but because of the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees is again prevalent. It's the prevalent teaching in society today. It's marked by both legalism and Talmudic situation ethics, which the Jews have brought us. And that is why we have a society where freedom is generally perceived as the right, more or less, to be a pervert instead of the freedom to try to do good or to do well. Wherever you turn in the educational systems today, in nearly every single field is permeated by the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. In 16:20, Yahshua ordered the students that they would tell no one that he is the Christ. A Jew would trumpet himself. How unlike a Jew? How dare he? I just had to mention that. 16:21. From that time, Yahshua Christ began to explain to his students that it is necessary for him to depart for Jerusalem and to suffer many things from the elders and the high priests and the scribes, and to be slain and to be raised on the third day. And taking him aside, Petros began to admonish him, saying, mercy to you, prince, this shall not be for you. And turning, he said to Petros, get behind me, adversary. And I noted the King James Version says Satan, and that's why I stopped here. I'll finish the verse. Are you a trap for me because you mind not the affairs of Yahweh, but the affairs of men? Here Yahshua calls Peter an adversary. It's not quite the same thing as calling him the Satan, even though it's the same Greek word, Satanas. But here there's no article. There's no proper definite article. An adversary is being used more or less as an adjective. Yahshua was explaining that he had to go to Jerusalem and suffer and die. And Peter spoke out against that. So therefore, he's being adversarial to Yahshua. I don't think that Peter and the other apostles at the time understood the prophecies of the Old Testament concerning the Christ and his first advent. They expected the kingdom to be returned to the children of Israel because they found a Messiah. They, not understanding the scriptures, perceived that the things prophesied for the second advent of Christ would occur at that time. And that's just simply not the way it was supposed to be. I just wanted to clear up the fact that Yahshua is not calling Peter by the proper term Satan, which is reserved in Scripture for the children of the devil, those who are adversarial to God. They are the Satan. Anybody at any particular time could be a Satan. A lot of non-seedliners like to point to this very verse and say, see? And that just falls apart upon the examination of the grammar and the context. There's another prophecy I'd like to discuss. There's something in Matthew 17 I would like to discuss that doesn't really, it's not really directly connected to two seed line, but I'd like to discuss it while we're walking through Matthew, because a lot of people get it screwed up and they think that it shows that there's such a thing as reincarnation, and that's not true, in my opinion. Matthew 17:9. And upon their descending from the mountain, Yahshua commanded them, saying, tell no one of this sight until when the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. And the students questioned him, saying, so why do the scribes say that it is necessary for Elijah to come first? And he replying said, indeed, Elijah comes, and he shall restore all things. But I say to you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but did with him whatever they had desired. Thusly also the Son of Man is going to suffer by them. Then the students understood that he spoke to them concerning John the Baptist. The prophecy of Elijah is also looking forward to a future fulfillment. For it is clear in Malachi chapter 4 that Elijah comes just before the judgment day. Malachi 4, 5-6. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and dreadful day of the Lord. And he shall turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the heart of the children to the fathers, lest I come and smite the earth with a curse. As the apostles thought, and it's evident in many places in Scripture, that Yahshua would deliver to them the kingdom at that time. So therefore, Yahshua seems to be improvising and comparing John the Baptist to Elijah, but not necessarily telling us that John the Baptist was Elijah. In other words, the prophecy doesn't necessitate that John the Baptist is personally Elijah the prophet. But somebody as powerful and with all the ability of Elijah the prophet. And today the spirit of Elijah the prophet will come, but it's not necessarily Elijah himself. It's simply men with the ability and the power that Elijah had. And we're still looking forward to that day. But I believe that the Christian identity message is the start of it, because no other sect in Christianity can claim to be paternalistic, to turn the hearts of the children to the fathers, as we are. All the other Christian sects are anti-paternalistic. They think that sperm is spiritual. Matthew chapter 19, verse 23. I'm going to read from verse 16. And behold, one having come forth said to him, teacher, what good shall I do that I would have eternal life? But he said to him, why would you speak to me concerning good? There is one who is good. But if you desire to enter into life, keep the commandments. So he says to him, which? And Yahshua said that you shall not murder, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not steal, you shall not testify falsely, honor your father and mother, and you shall love he who is near to you as yourself. The young man says to him, I have kept all these things. What more do I want? Yahshua said to him, if you wish to be perfect, go sell your belongings and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in the heavens, and come follow me. And hearing this word, the young man departed grieving, for he was holding much property. Then Yahshua said to his students, truly I say to you, that with difficulty a wealthy man shall enter into the kingdom of the heavens. And again I say to you, it is easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a wealthy man to enter into the kingdom of Yahweh. And hearing it, the students were exceedingly astonished, saying, who then is able to be saved? Then looking at them, Yahshua said, with men this is impossible, but with Yahweh all things are possible. This doesn't really, well, it does mesh very well with two-C-line doctrine, once you take a thorough look at history. It's clear that the wealthiest classes in European society, from the 1700s at least, have been intermarrying with the Edomite Jews, with their own bankers, and they've been doing it for 300 years. Today, most of the British nobility are Jewish or have Jewish in-laws. Adolf Hitler wrote about the German nobles in the 1800s and said that they had been giving their sons and daughters to the Jewish bankers for quite some time. It's only natural that when you allow a minority people into your economy, and they're much wealthier than you are because they have the ability to create their own money, which Christians don't have, and Christians don't loan out money at interest, then it's only natural that they're going to gain enough wealth to control you and to intermingle themselves with you. And that's what's happened. Most rich men today, they're corrupt. They're pawns of the enemy. Of course they're not going to enter into the kingdom of heaven if they're not crypto Jews themselves, Bill Gates, Warren Buffett. Look at them. When they do good, it's evil. Bill Gates puts up $1 billion for a scholarship that he made from white people because black people really don't buy computer software. And he makes a black-only scholarship. He did that 12 years ago. But that's typical of his philanthropy. It's only another form of Marxism. It's disguised, but it's there. And that's what rich people do to us. Matthew chapter 21, verse 12. And Yahshua had entered into the temple, and he cast out all the dealers and buyers in the temple, and overturned the tables of the bankers and the seats of those selling doves. And he says to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you make it a den of robbers. I'm going to skip ahead to verse 18. Then at dawn, going back to the city, he hungered. And seeing one fig tree by the road, he came upon it and found nothing in it except leaves only. And he says to it, no longer shall it be fruit from you forever. And immediately the fig tree withered. This fig tree can only be representative of those people, the authorities in Jerusalem, who were the subject of discussion in the events which precede and which follow the cursing of the fig tree. This also must be the fig tree mentioned in Matthew 24:32. In Matthew 24:32, Yahshua is giving, he's answering several questions. He's answering when Jerusalem is going to be destroyed and when the return of the Son of Man will be. And I believe he's answering the second half of that, or the later half of that, when he says, now learn from the parable of the fig tree, when already its branches should be tender, and it would produce leaves. You know that summer is near. Well, it took thousands of years. It took 2,000 years almost. But these same people with their same practices have actually infiltrated all of Christendom and come to rule over it. They ruled over Judea at the time of Christ, and they had a lot of influence throughout the rest of the nations of the world. I mean, Nero, the emperor, his wife was a Jewess. They had their Jewish bankers, their Edomite Jewish bankers in London and in Susa and in Babylon and in the cities of Greece. They more or less controlled quite a bit of the world then with their influence until Christianity, when Constantine had legitimized it, forced them out of the kingdom. They didn't get back into power in Christian nations until the Enlightenment, which really is not an enlightenment by any means. It's really an endarkenment. It's when secular humanism and all the other isms of the Jews came into vogue and began once again to replace the true religion of Yahweh. They did it in Judea 2,000 years ago, and they did it again in the West today. It's the same fig tree. And today, they're prevalent in every facet of society. They're those branches that Yahshua said, when they shoot forth, know that summer is nigh. And I believe that's what time of day it is. That the judgment's not too far away. It might be another generation or two, but it can't go on much further, and that's really a topic for another program. I'd like to read Matthew 21:33. Hear another parable. There was a man, a master of a house, who planted a vineyard and put a fence around it and dug a trough in it and built a tower and let it out to husbandmen. And he traveled abroad. Then when the time for the fruits approached, he sent his servants to the husbandmen to receive of its fruits, to get his cut, his rent. And the husbandmen, taking his servants, then cudgeled one and killed another and stoned another. So again he sent other servants, more than the first. And they did likewise to them. Then later he sent to them his son, saying, no respect, my son. But the husbandmen, seeing the son, said among themselves, he is the heir. Come, we should kill him, that we would have his inheritance. And taking him, they cast him outside of the vineyard, and they killed him. So when the master of the house should come, what shall he do to those husbandmen? They say to him, meaning the apostles, say to him, he shall destroy the wicked one horribly, and let the vineyard out to other husbandmen, who shall render to him the fruits in their seasons. And this is the story of Christ. He gave a parable telling his own story. He's the son, and he went to Jerusalem to the husbandmen. Those Edomite Jews, they weren't the heirs. If they were children of Yahweh, if they were Israelites, Yahshua wouldn't be able to give this parable because they would be co-heirs with Christ. So his own parables prove over and over again that these people are usurpers, and this is a very explicit one. The husbandmen are not the heirs, and that's clear in many places in Scripture, that the children of Israel are the heirs. So these husbandmen, they can't be the children of Israel. The servants of the prophets, and the husbandmen killed them, and then they killed the son. This goes hand in hand with Luke 11:45-52. Then replying, and I'm going to read Luke 11:45-52. Then replying, one of the lawyers said to him, "Teacher, saying these things, you also insult us." So he said, "And woe to you lawyers, because you load men with burdens hard to bear, and these burdens you touch with not one of your own fingers. Woe to you, because you build the monuments of the prophets, and your fathers killed them. Therefore you are witnesses, and you consent to the works of your fathers, because they killed them, and you build. For this reason also the wisdom of Yahweh says, I shall send to them prophets and ambassadors, and some of them they shall kill, and they shall persecute, in order that the blood of all the prophets spilled from the foundation of society should be required from this race. From the blood of Abel, unto the blood of Zacharias, who was killed between the altar and the house, yea, I say to you, it shall be required from this race. Woe to you, lawyers, because you have taken the key of knowledge, you do not enter in yourselves, and you prohibit those who are entering in." With this statement, it's clear that the Edomite Jews in Jerusalem are not themselves entering into the kingdom of heaven. So they prevent, or they attempt to prevent, those who are entering in. Talking about fathers and sons, near and remote, the word genos in Luke can't be translated generation as the AV has it, as the King James has it. It has to be translated race. And only the race of Cain could possibly be responsible for the death of Abel. None of the Seth line existed. The Seth line that Abraham and Israel, Jacob, descended from, can't possibly be responsible for the death of Abel. Only the descendants of Cain can be responsible for the death of Abel. Couple this with the parable of the vineyard, which I just read from Matthew, and beyond all doubt, there's another seed line. People who aren't heirs, people who aren't Israel, and Yahshua Christ is telling these scribes and Pharisees that that's where they belong. If we read back in the Old Testament, we'll see that the Edomites and the Hittites and the Canaanites were always around amongst the children of Israel because the children of Israel failed to extinguish them when they were told to back in the days of Joshua. They're the ones that killed the prophets. They're the race that killed the prophets and the priests of Yahweh, Doug the Edomite, Jezebel the Canaanite. There's evidence over and over again. They're the ones that killed Christ. The Edomites amongst us today that have been responsible for all our wars. They've been our bankers for 400 years. It's they who caused the Civil War in America. 500,000 Saxons died. It's they who caused all the wars of Europe. World War I, Napoleon's Wars, and probably a lot more than that. World War II, the Bolshevik Revolution. It's the same people. Christians just won't ever wake up to it. Matthew 22, verse 1. And responding, Yahshua again spoke in parables to them, saying, "The kingdom of the heavens may be compared to a man who was king, who has made a feast, a wedding feast for his son. And he sent his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding feast, and they did not wish to come. Again he sent other servants, saying, Tell those who were invited, Behold, my dinner is prepared. My bulls and fatlings are sacrificed, and all things are ready. Come to the wedding feast. But they, being uncaring, departed, indeed one to his own farm and another to his business. For the rest, seizing his servants, assaulted and killed them. And the king, being angered and sending his armies, destroyed those murderers and burned their city. Then he says to his servants, "The wedding feast is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Therefore, go along the outlets of the roads, and as many as you should find, invite to the wedding feast." And those servants, having gone out into the roads, gathered all whom they found, both the wicked and the good. And the wedding feast had been filled with those dining. Then the king, upon entering to observe those dining there, saw a man not clothed in a wedding garment. And he says to him, "Friend, how have you entered into here, not having a wedding garment?" But he was silent. Then the king said to the servants, "Binding his hands and feet, cast them out into the outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen." I discussed this parable a few weeks ago, and now I'm going to discuss it again. I probably won't do as good a job. The wedding feast, the people invited to the wedding feast are the Judeans that kept the old covenant, because Zechariah says that Judah, the tents of Judah, shall be saved first. Well, none of them cared. The ones that didn't care, they're apathetic Israelites. I'm sure a lot of them are apathetic because they weren't properly taught by the scribes and the Pharisees. Those who seized the servants and killed them, well, they're the Edomite Jews. They're the scribes and the Pharisees. Yahshua has already explained to us that his children didn't, the hares didn't kill them, the husbandmen did. They are the husbandmen. They're sent out into the streets to find whoever they can. They're the lost sheep in the house of Israel. And bring them into the wedding feast. They didn't know the scriptures. They left them behind. They left them behind 700 years before this. They were Israelites, but they didn't know the Messiah was coming. The people in Judea, they should have known the Messiah was coming. Some of them did. The apostles surely did. And they anticipated his arrival. The man without the wedding garment, well, I believe that that wedding garment is your skin. And when they went out and collected all the lost sheep of the house of Israel, the servants of God, the servants of Yahweh, they picked up a few that didn't belong. And we see today they load the church with those that don't belong. But they're not wearing wedding garments. They're not children of Adam. They're not going to be admitted into the kingdom of Yahweh. They can't be saved. I know Patricia asked me once that the person who held the wedding gave out the wedding garments on the day of the wedding to the attendees who showed up. And I should have answered at that time, and I kind of did, but not as directly, that Yahweh did give us out wedding garments. He gave them to us when we were born. Matthew chapter 23. This whole chapter is an attack by Yahshua Christ on the methods of the scribes and the Pharisees. And I don't think I could do better than to just read the chapter. I'll try to comment on it in between. I don't know if I could say anything that could add to it that's better than what's there. I'm sure I can't. 23:1. Then Yahshua spoke to the crowds and to his students, saying, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit upon the seat of Moses. Therefore, all things whatever they should tell you, you do and you keep. But according to their deeds, you do not do. For they say and do not do. And they bind heavy burdens upon men and hard to bear and lay them upon the shoulders of men. But they with their own fingers do not wish to move them." I'm sorry, I'm paraphrasing. "And all their deeds they do for which to be observed by men. For they broaden their phylacteries," in other words, they make their suits look nice, "and they make great their fringes, and they love the best seats at the dinners and the first benches in the assembly halls, and at the greetings in the markets to be called by men rabbi." I'm going to say a few things about this. The scribes and the Pharisees sit upon the seats of Moses. Therefore, all things whatever they should tell you, you do and you keep. And I was thinking the other day while I was emailing somebody that inquired about it, about the way that a lot of us in Israel identity, in Christian Israel identity, we like to take the term Lord and replace it with the term Yahweh, which is the old scriptural name of our God and Father. And they say, well, that's not biblical because the apostles didn't write that name. And they're right. The apostles didn't write that name. But there's solid evidence that for 400 years, at least, and we know Moses wrote the name, but that's where the scriptures come from. But there's archaeological evidence that for 400 years, or I'm sorry, for 600 years, because we have the silver scrolls, which date to about 600 B.C., that we found in under the ground in Jerusalem, all the way down to the time of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the Qumran sect wrote the name Yahweh in the scriptures. And in fact, they usually wrote it in Paleo Hebrew, even when they wrote copies of Greek scriptures. But the scribes and the Pharisees, according to Josephus the historian, they forbid the use of the name Yahweh. And they had forbid that for a couple of hundred years before the time of Christ. And that's clear in the manuscripts of the Septuagint that exist, that the Greek terms, wherever the Hebrew texts say Yahweh, in the Septuagint, the Greek term kurios is used as an appellative. So Yahshua tells his disciples to do what the scribes and the Pharisees say. So the disciples aren't going to use the name Yahweh when they write the Gospels. They're going to use the appellative kurios, and that's what they did. However, I would retort that the scribes and the Pharisees, in 70 A.D., when Jerusalem was destroyed, they were ripped off of that seat of Moses. So since they're not sitting on it anymore, I'm going to use the name Yahweh. And I'm going to re-replace kurios with Yahweh, which is what I did in my translation of the New Testament. And if you want to use Lord, or Lord Yahweh, I'm not going to beat you over the head. And there are people in identity to do that. There are pastors that do that. They'll tell you that you have to use the name Yahweh. And I could never do that. I'm not going to tell you you have to do anything. That's brotherly love. If you want to use the name Lord, be my guest. If you want to use Jesus, be my guest. I explained in my pamphlet, Yahshua to Jesus, the derivation of the name, I explained as carefully as I could how the name, the Hebrew name Yahshua, actually did evolve through Greek, through Latin, and into English, into the word Jesus. So the word Jesus is ultimately derived directly from the Hebrew word Yahshua. And I prefer to use the term Yahshua because it means something. It means Yahweh saves. The word Jesus doesn't really mean anything. And when I use the name and refer to him, I like to recall the meaning and to convey that meaning in my language. So, even though I prefer to use Yahshua, I'm not going to beat a brother over the head because he prefers the name Jesus. Because that's not brotherly love. We both know who he means. So yeah, I have a little different spin on that than a lot of, Pete Peters will throw you out of his congregation because you use the name Yahshua. And that shows you what an idiot he is. And we have that in writing right from his own ministry that he does things like that. He disinvites and escorts out people that use the appellatives Yahweh and Yahshua, which to me is totally blasphemous. It's a total blasphemy. I mean, you don't have to use the terms, but it's a blasphemy for disassociating yourself with me because I do. That's the way it is. That's not brotherly love. That's not following the commandment to love your brother. That's actually, that's Phariseeism is what it is. Pete Peters is no better than a Pharisee. Matthew 23, verses 5, 6, and 7 show that the rabbis, like today's priests, they like to look good, and they like the honors that befall their positions, but they're empty and vain and hollow. That's all they like, the honor and the money. Matthew 23:8. But you should not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, and you are all brothers. And you shall not call your father upon the earth, for one is your father, the heavenly. Neither should you be called guides, because one is your guide, the Christ. And he who is greater among you shall be your servant. But whoever should exalt himself and shall be humbled, and whoever should humble himself shall be exalted. I really don't like to self-promote myself, but that's why I'd never use a title. I don't like being called by any titles. Just Bill is good for me. And I'm not going to knock men like Eli that do use titles, and I don't knock them. But I try not to use any titles, and that's one reason why. We're all brethren. I don't like vowels being put on the end of my name. We're all brethren, and we should treat each other like that. And I like to try to forego the formalities because they lead to feelings of esteem, and they lead to the elevation of one brother over another that I agree that we should avoid. Matthew 23:13. And woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you shut up the kingdom of the heavens before men. For you do not enter in, nor do you allow those entering in to enter. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you go about the sea in the desert to make one convert, and when it happens, you make him a son of Gehenna twice as much as yourself. Woe to you, blind guides, who say, he who should swear by the temple, it is nothing. But he should, now this sounds like a Jew, but he who should swear by the gold of the temple, he is obligated. Foolish and blind men, for what is greater, the gold or the temple which sanctifies the gold? And he who should swear by the altar, it is nothing. But he who should swear by the gift upon it, he is obligated. Foolish and blind men, for what is greater, the gift or the altar which sanctifies the gift? Therefore, he who is sworn by the altar swears by it and by all things which are upon it. And he who is sworn by the temple swears by it and by him dwelling in it. And he who is sworn by heaven swears by the throne of Yahweh and by him sitting upon it. Well, it's obvious that the Jews were making false oaths. And I really don't have a cultural context to put this discourse in, because I don't think one exists today. And I haven't read about oaths in the Talmud. I'm sure maybe if we did, we could understand what Yahshua is saying, why he's so heavily critical of them for taking these oaths. Verse 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you give a tenth of the mint and anise and the cumin, and neglect the weightier matters of the law, judgment and mercy and faith. Legalism more or less eliminates love, mercy, and faith, because legalism allows no room for the people who make mistakes and are repentant. Yet it is necessary to do these things and not neglect those others. In other words, it's necessary to follow the law, but don't neglect judgment, mercy, and faith. Blind guides, straining out a gnat, you swallow a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you cleanse the outside of the cup and the dish, but the insides are filled from rapine and incontinence. Blind Pharisees, cleanse first the insides of the cup and the dish, in order that the outsides of them shall be clean. In other words, if your body's clean on the inside, it's clean on the outside. One follows the other. And the Romans had a saying that a clean mind was a sound body, and that's true. And that's basically what Christ is saying here. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you are like whitewashed tombs, which indeed appear beautiful outside, but inside are full of the bones of corpses and all uncleanness. Tell me that doesn't describe most Jews and most Catholic priests today. Thusly, indeed, you also appear outside righteous to men, but inside you are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. That's half the clergy. That's half the Christian clergy. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous. And you say, if we were in the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners in the blood of the prophets. Thusly, you bear witness against yourselves that you were the sons of those who murdered the prophets. Here we have it. The scribes and the Pharisees, he's talking to, were the Edomite Jews. And you shall fulfill the measure of your fathers, serpents, race of vipers. How could you escape from the judgment of Gehenna? Two seed line permeates the Bible. Go back in the Old Testament. See who's responsible for the blood of all the prophets from Abel to Zechariah. And that Zechariah is the father of John the Baptist, by the way. And you'll see that the Edomite Jews and the Canaanites are responsible for the murder of the prophets from A to Z, from Abel to Zechariah. It's a play on words in English. Oddly, that's not a play on words in Greek, because in Greek, and Yahshua did speak Greek here, Zechariah, Z is about the seventh letter of the alphabet. For some strange reason, it became the last in English. I don't know how, but it did. But it's the seventh letter of the Greek alphabet. So it's not even close to a wordplay in Greek. That's not the only, there are other wordplays that Yahshua made that are wordplays in English but not in Greek. And I think that in itself is quite prophetic. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, because you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous, and you say, if we were in the days of our fathers, we would not have been their partners in the blood of the prophets. Christ is telling them that they prove at that time by their own mouths that they were Edomite, Canaanite Jews. They were not Judah. They were not Israel. And that's exactly what he's telling them. Thusly, you bear witness against yourselves that you were the sons of those who murdered the prophets. He goes on to call them a race of serpents and a race of vipers. For this reason, behold, I send to you prophets and wise men and scribes. Some of them you shall kill and crucify, and some of them you shall flog in your assembly halls and persecute from city to city. Thusly should come upon you all the righteous blood poured out upon the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel unto Zacharias, who had been murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things shall come upon this race. There we have it. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, she kills the prophets and stones those being sent to her. How often have I desired to gather your children, by which manner a hen gathers her chicks between her wings, and you desired it not. Behold, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, by no means may you see me, from now until you should say, blessed is he coming in the name of Yahweh. The gospel was used by Yahweh to separate the wheat from the tares. Yahshua Christ didn't point each of these people out and say, you're an Edomite and you're an Israelite. and you're an Israelite. He didn't separate people like that. He let the word do it. And it happened then, and it's going to happen again here real soon. Matthew chapter 25, verse 31. And when the Son of Man should come in his effulgence, and all the messengers with him, then he shall sit upon his throne of honor, and they shall gather before him all the nations, and he shall separate them one from another, just as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he shall indeed stand the sheep at his right hand, and the goats at his left. Then the king shall say to those at his right hand, Come, those blessed of my father, you shall inherit the kingdom that has been prepared for you from the foundation of society. For I hungered, and you gave me to eat. I had thirst, and you had given me to drink. I was a visitor, and you had taken me in. Naked, and you had clothed me. I had been sick, and you watched over me. I was in prison, and you had come to me. Then the righteous shall respond to him, saying, Master, when have we seen you hungry and nourished you, or thirsting and had given drink? And when have we seen you a visitor and had taken you in, or naked and had clothed you? And when have we seen you being sick or in prison and come to you? And replying, the king shall say to them, Truly I say to you, for whomever of the least of my brethren have you done one of these things, you have done them for me. Then he shall say to those at the left hand, Go from me, accursed, into the eternal fire, which has been prepared for the false accuser and his messengers, or for the devil and his messengers. For I hungered, and you did not give me to eat. And I had thirst, and you would not give me drink. I was a visitor, and you had not taken me in. Naked, and you had not clothed me. Sick and in prison, and you had not visited me. Then they themselves shall respond, saying, Master, when have we seen you hungry or thirsting or a visitor or naked or sick or in prison and had not served you? And he shall respond to them, saying, Truly, I say to you, for whomever you had not done one of the least of these things, neither have you done them for me. And they shall go off into the eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. It has to be noted that the sheep and the goats are nations. Paul, in Romans chapter 2, commended the Romans for creating a society based on rule of law, which is a reflection of that law written in their hearts, and therefore a fulfillment of the prophecy of Jeremiah chapter 31. No society is formed from the top down. As Thomas Jefferson told us, governments can only exist with the consent of the governed. And what I'm driving at is that some people, some nations, are capable of forming civil societies based upon the rule of law and a respect for one's fellow man. Other societies are not capable of that. The non-white people of the world, the non-Adamites or the non-Israelites today, generally live by the law of the jungle, while the white nations generally live by the laws of God. Surely, not all of us are perfect, but we are able to have a society, and a good society, basically, because most of us are good most of the time, and some of us are good nearly all of the time. Here in Matthew 25, Yahshua is talking about nations and not individuals. There are nations who generally do his will. And most other peoples don't do his will. Visit the sick, care for the poor, take care of widows, give shelter to orphans. To do these things, a nation has to build hospitals, charities, nursing facilities, child care centers, schools, and orphanages. It has to develop institutions that can do these things. Only the Adamic people in this world, the white man, has developed these institutions, which were absolutely unknown to any of the other races until they were forced to mimic white men through our own imperialism. They only have those things today at our beckoning. All the other races of the world exist just one blind eye away from total savagery. As soon as the white man leaves his nation and turns his back, they are all eating each other in no time at all. We enforce the rule of law in the world. We build the world's hospitals. We take care of the orphans. We develop adoption systems. We develop systems to help seniors, to help old people and widows. We are the sheep nations. We act it. The other races, they turn into wolves. I mean, some of them might try to be sheep while we're around, while they're being watched, while they know that they're going to be hit in the head as soon as they try to act like a wolf. As soon as we leave, they're wolves. The sheep and the goats are nations. Judgment between sheep nations and goat nations is not merely a matter of this parable. This isn't the only place it exists. It might be the only place it's mentioned in the New Testament, but I'm going to read Ezekiel chapter 34, verse 17. And as for you, O my flock, thus saith Yahweh God, behold, I judge between cattle and cattle, between the rams and the he-goats. Ezekiel 34, 22 and 23. Therefore will I save my flock, and they shall no more be a prey, meaning be a prey to the wolves and the dogs, and I will judge between cattle and cattle, and I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them. Even my servant David, he shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd. Yahweh's telling us in Ezekiel that he's going to separate cattle and cattle, rams and goats, sheep and goats. Rams are male sheep, by the way. So the goats are going to be put off in the Old Testament, and Yahshua Christ tells us in the New Testament that it's the same. It hasn't changed. Christianity hasn't changed God. The Judeo-Christians try to convince us of that, but it's a lie. The word hasn't changed. Yahshua Christ says the sheep go on the right side and into eternal life. The goats go on the left side and into eternal punishment. And the sheep are nations, and the goats are nations. Well, there's only one kind of sheep nations, and that's Christendom. They're the white nations of the world. Everybody else is a goat. There's no third category here. And nothing's changed from the Old Testament. That is the end of my two seed line discourse tonight. I know it's only 9:15. I expected Eli to be here. And didn't prepare for his not being here. He had spoke to me Thursday evening and told me that he had minor complications from his surgery last week and that he had to get it taken care of today. And I hope things didn't get too bad because I had a message from Greg Howard rather late. For some reason, my main telephone was out, and Eli couldn't get through to me. I don't carry my cell phone around the house. Greg Howard has my third number, and Eli doesn't. So Greg Howard had called me and told me Eli wouldn't make it today, that his medical problem persisted. If he's not with me tomorrow night, I'll continue the Paul discourse with 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and that's at 8 o'clock here tomorrow night. And on Sunday, I'm going to be on with Sword Brethren at 6 p.m., and him and I are going to discuss the ancient manuscripts that our scriptures are derived from, and that various biblical translations were taken from, to try to put that all in perspective so that people, well, I pray that I might impart a slightly better understanding of that. Thank you all, and I'll see you tomorrow night. Praise Yahweh.